Every Friday morning, 10 a.m. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Noll Show. And now, your host, Gary Noll.
Mike Wallace and Aldous Huxley, who wrote Brave New World. This interview was in 1958. And what's important about this interview is that he predicted what we're going through now. He gives a very dystopian view, but it's honest and it's real, and I believe that we should pay careful attention to it. Also today, I'll be doing a commentary, as well as sharing a commentary from a recent article by Professor Henry Giroux, and he is quite simply one of our finest intellects, and his commentary is in Truth Out, entitled History Holds the Antidote to Trump's Fascist Politics. I will also take some calls, and from the people who call in, please remember, you can call in and make a comment about maybe you heard a show in our archives, so you're not listening live. 95% of the people listening to this program are not listening at noon to 1 Eastern Standard Time, Monday to Friday, or 7 to 8 on Tuesday evenings for the Progressive Commentary. They're listening at some distant time, maybe a day or a week later. So let's say you hear something you think, I'd like to share my insight on that. We welcome those insights. And our voicemail number, please write this down, to ask a question or to share a comment, is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. Our archive number, so you can always, no matter where you're at, retrieve up to 5 programs with one call, 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. Or, of course, you can, if that's no longer has enough, let's say, progressive commentary archive number, because that's got our absolutely best programs, 701-719-0999, 701-719-0999. So we begin always with the latest on health and healing. And for this one, we're looking at pomegranates. Now, we can't always get pomegranates fresh, but we can get them in concentrate or in juice. I suggest concentrate because you're getting about 3 times the potency in a concentrate as you would in a juice. Now, this is from the University of Albany, and it says that plants are, of course, providing us with anti-cancer agents. We know that broccoli, the cruciferous vegetables, cauliflower, kale, watercress, radishes. But according to numerous studies, certain plants possess powerful chemicals that can do what conventional cancer treatments cannot, meaning stop drug-resistant cancer stem cells. See, within the tumor mass, there's the progenitor, meaning the mother lode of all power to that cancer, and that's called a cancer stem cell. Well, in a recent study published in Nutrition and Cancer, researchers from the University of Albany in New York revealed that pomegranates can be used in the prevention of breast cancer due to their ability to suppress cancer stem cells, which have become important targets of cancer therapy. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, because I know that not everyone in this audience knows what a cancer stem cell is. So just very briefly, cancer stem cells refer to a small subpopulation of cells that can be found in tumors. And as their name implies, cancer stem cells are capable of self-renewal. and transforming into any cell type. But what makes these cells dangerous is that they also have the same characteristics as cancer cells. Cancer stem cells are responsible not just for the development of tumors, but also for their progression and metastasis and drug resistance. Cancer stem cells are not affected by chemotherapy and radiotherapy. That oncologists rarely, if ever, tell a patient. In fact, some studies have reported these treatments actually increase their number and malignancy. You don't have to trust this information. You can go to the peer-reviewed literature on PubMed, and it's right there. And in that language, you will see study after study after study that there's a carcinogenicity, meaning the treatment itself causes cancer. So why do they do it? Well, it's relatively simple. Their idea is kill cancer cells at such a high level that you kill most of them before the cancer kills the body's healthy cells or that the therapy kills the healthy cells. Seems kind of convoluted intellectually, doesn't it? Well, it is. Because if you have cancer treatment and you do not die, 100% of the credit goes to the treatment, none to you, based upon your mindset or what you might have done to change your lifestyle that could have contributed to the cancer, unwittingly so. In any case, the existence of cancer stem cells was a random discovery. Researchers were investigating the cause of a common form of blood cell cancer known as acute myeloid leukemia when they noticed a small fraction of the cell population that was different from the rest. And these cells were still capable of dividing while the majority of the leukemic cells had already lost their ability. So when they transferred some of these curious cells to a mouse, they initiated a new incidence of leukemia. The cells also showed resistance to chemotherapy and rapidly replenished the leukemic cell population right after therapy. This caused the reoccurrence of the leukemia. So today, researchers know these cells as cancer stem cells, and they also know these cells have the same DNA mutations as ordinary cancer cells, but behave differently due to their stem cell-like nature. As for the origin of these cells, researchers believe they are most likely the product of a cell reprogramming, which has been observed in a variety of tumors. So pomegranate, on the other hand, comes along this wonderful fruit. It's actually a fruit-bearing shrub. I grow pomegranates. And they're very good because they're very resistant to insects. Rarely, if ever, see one that's destroyed because of an insect. And they're delicious when they're ripe. It's a native to Asian countries. It was principally cultivated in the Mediterranean region since ancient times. And the plant has now a lot of interest. There are thousands of studies because of its anti-inflammatory properties. And especially what is called ellagic, E-L-L-A-G-I-C acid, and anthocyanins, and what is also called punicalagin, P-U-N-I-C-A-L-A-G-I-N, and other what are called hydrolyzable tannins. These are all healing properties that can turn off inflammation, hence they could help with arthritis, pain, they could help with diabetes, they could help stop the inflammation of the pancreas, they could help men stop the inflammation of the prostate gland, they could help stop the inflammation that can lead to cancer in the breast and uterine area. So very, very important. And now we know that there's a lot of anti-cancer activity with pomegranates. So wanted to share a little bit more information than normal on an item, but it's kind of like our classroom on the air. But at least now you know more of why you should use it on a daily basis. Also, from the Wien Medical University in Austria, they did a study with rhodiola, R-H-O-D-I-O-L-A, rosea, R-O-S-E-A, and it had an enormous benefit for people suffering from burnout syndrome. And this was the purpose of the study because we have an awful lot of people who simply are burned out because of stress. So the aim of the treatment was to increase stress resistance, and not just the symptoms or the syndrome, but actually prevent subsequent diseases associated with being overstressed. Remember, a lot of your diseases, including heart disease, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, can come from being stressed. Stress kills, but doesn't kill quickly. It takes time, but you start adapting to stress in your life. Let's say you adapt to someone that just doesn't speak calmly with you, but yells. And one day you've adapted to their yelling. That doesn't mean you're any less stressed by it. It means that you've adapted to a bad situation. Think of the environments that we have worked in that were toxic. We adapt frequently, or the people in our lives. And I'm not a big believer in maladaptation. I believe in transformation. Take a bad situation, what can I do to make it better? And so that's what they wanted to see. And lo and behold, after 12 weeks on rhodiola, there was a major capacity, the good results, very positive. So if you are stressed and you want to help protect your body from the consequences of stress and burnout, then try that. And rhodiola you can get everywhere. It's very common. You buy it in any health food store. Also, apathy. Why is that important? Because it's now considered the forgotten symptom of dementia. Now, this is in the University of Exeter. Apathy, by the way, is the most common neuropsychiatric symptom of dementia, with a bigger impact on function than on memory loss. Yet it is almost never discussed. And a new study has found that apathy is present nearly half of all people with dementia, with researchers finding it often distinct from depression. So although common, apathy is also ignored, as it is less disruptive in settings such as care homes than if you're aggressive. Aggression is dealt with antipsychotic and antidepressive medication. But apathy is important. In fact, apathy is one of the topics I'll be dealing with and helping people with during the four Sundays in August. I'll be helping people deal with sadness, depression, withdrawal from their energy of life, lack of enthusiasm for life, and apathy, because they all have the same outcome, shorter lifespan and misery, loneliness. But in any case, when we see that someone is not living with vibrancy, then we should intercede and try to bring things that are exciting and new and fresh. You know, take someone and say, hey, why don't we take a language course? Why don't we learn to play an instrument? Why don't we learn folk dancing? There's so many things that you can do that takes a person out of their apathy and gets them re-engaged in putting positive energy forward. But if you don't deal with that, or maybe a person's isolated themselves, they're lonely, maybe their friends have died, maybe they're separated from their family, a lot of reasons to get into this place. Resignation is one of them, when we resign ourselves to we don't have the power to change the circumstances in our life. And indeed, that is true for some people. So I think we have, not that I think, I know we have a moral responsibility to help people in their hour of need. So if you see apathy, come up with constructive, and there's lots of books out there and videos on dealing with apathy. But be very careful, because most people won't deal with it except take them to a psychologist, psychiatrist, and suddenly they're prescribed an antidepressant. Now, the psychologist can recommend antidepressants. The psychiatrist or physician will give them the prescription, and that's not good. Why? University of East Anglia, which is in the United Kingdom, is now showing that regular use of antidepressants is linked to dementia. So how is it good to take one condition that is behavioral and life situational and create a physiological condition that is very negative and frequently irreversible as a consequence. So antidepressants and antihistamines are among the most common types of medications people take, and they belong to a class of drugs known as the anticholinergics. And these drugs can treat a variety of health problems, but I never suggest antidepressant medication because there's all forms of side effects, and dementia is one of those side effects. And finally, fermented red clover extract stops menopausal hot flashes and symptoms. Now, we know that Fotai, Dong Quai, Vitex, Squalvine are all important in helping with menopausal symptoms, especially hot flashes and night sweats. However, fermented red clover, again, fermented red clover, can do the same. This is according to Aarhus University in Denmark. So most of the women going through menopause experience hot flashes and hormonal fluctuations. But if red clover is taken in a fermented form, it decreases significantly on both the number and severity of daily hot flashes, and it's natural. Non-toxic, you're not going to have any negative side effects. Oh, and by the way, from Ohio State University, you want to cut skin cancer risk? A diet rich in tomatoes, tomato juice, tomato sauces, tomatoes. And that's because, and this was published in Scientific Reports, and that's because of the nutrients that are in the tomato. And so take tomatoes in different forms, including it's going to have lycopene in there, and it's more bioavailable. And also, by the way, tangerine tomatoes would be your best for that purpose. And walnuts lower your cardiovascular disease risk by boosting endothelial function. This was a meta-analysis. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll take some of your calls. Please stay with us.
Gary, the half moons that are at the base of the fingernails are gone from some of my nails. What are the health implications, if any, and what can be done for this if need be? Thank you.
Okay, well, you're not alone. Most people end up looking down at their fingernails and toenails and noticing that there's chipping, flaking, thinness, sometimes their discoloration, purplishness, yellowishness, and a thickening of the fingernail or toenail ridges, and the loss of the half moon. More often than not, this is due to nutritional deficiencies. And remember, the nail is simply a substructure of the epidermis, and that the epidermis is your outer layer of skin, and it's composed mainly of keratin, which is a type of protein. And the nail bed is the skin on top of which the nail grows. And everyone has nails that grow at different speeds based upon the richness of the blood supply. So your microcirculation is crucial. And if you have changes that are dramatic, then there's something wrong generally inside the body. Frequently it's a lack of quality protein, and now you can get good plant-based proteins like split pea protein, rice protein, hemp protein, folic acid, and vitamin C. Those are common. Vitamin A and calcium causes deficiency diet causes dryness and brittleness, and a B complex deficiency will cause the vertical and horizontal ridges. And insufficient take of vitamin B12, which a lot of people have, will lead to very rounded and curved nail ends and darkened nails. iron deficiency, you get that kind of spoon, that dip in the nail. So it's developing a concave shape. And zinc deficiency will cause the development of the white spots on the nails. And you need healthy bacteria, the good probiotics, and then that can help stop the fungus under the nails. And if your stomach is digesting properly because you have adequate hydrochloric acid, that can keep the nails from splitting. So probiotics, silica, or horsetail, or oat straw, vitamin A, black currant seed oil helps with weak or brittle nails, and B complex at about 50 to 100 milligrams, and especially B12 at 1 milligram, and folic acid at 1 milligram, vitamin C at 5 to 10,000, and zinc at about 15 milligrams, plus black cohosh, C-O-H-O-S-H, and burdock root and dandelion root, and gotu kola. Gotu kola is G-O-T-U-K-O-L-A. Borage oil is good. Olive oil is good. Primrose oil is good. Pumpkin seed oil is good. And then finally, to make sure you're getting proper microcirculation, ginkgo biloba, rosemary, and turmeric. Okay, we'll take one more.
Hi, Gary. I wanted to ask a question. What is your opinion on psychedelic drug? Okay, thank you.
Psychedelics. Well, psychedelics. Let's just say over the last 5 years, there has been an enormous amount of research into hallucinogenic plants. And I'm not talking about LSD or mescaline. I'm talking about something that's natural. And this has mainly been because the Veterans Administration is seeing over a million vets who are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, there is an important molecule in most of these hallucinogenic plants. It's called DMT. It's a dimethyltryptamine, which is the Amazonian brew, and it's not like synthetics, and it does really last a long time. And research has been done. I believe the University of Michigan has done some research on natural substances, and now they're looking at that psychedelics impact melatonin in large amounts with, will synthesize eventually into DMT. And that's why in Asia, the rare people who do what are called dark retreats, being darkness for months and more, will synthesize enormous amounts of melatonin in the pineal gland, which is considered the third eye, which in turn synthesizes into DMT. That in complete darkness, they can, in effect, see everything in the room, cave or space. And you might remember that René Descartes called the pineal gland the seat of the soul. Now, John Hopkins, just this year, found that DMT is associated with rapid reduction in anxiety and depression. That's good. I believe there was another John Hopkins study of thousands of people who tried different hallucinogens, and most claimed that they experienced important revelations and insights into their own lives. And the American Psychological Association even hosted a large session on the use of psychedelics, mushrooms, for example. And University of California says that DMT increased the brain's neuroplasticity. And John Hopkins on mushroom study found that it was successful in helping addiction with alcohol, cocaine, and smoking. And UCLA did a study on mushrooms that treated cancer and psychological distress from it. And there are over 100 species of hallucinogenic mushrooms worldwide. And these, you know, there's a lots of studies that it stimulates growth of new brain cells, improves memory. It reduces emotional pain from social rejection and lack of self-acceptance. It alleviates obsessive-compulsive disorder. It improves connections and interface with the brain's neural wiring. It's used actually in hospice care with amazing results for acceptance of life and death. And most importantly, it helps people with post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's an anti-inflammatory, and it treats cluster headaches. But there are adverse effects. There's no evidence of chemical toxicity and no serious adverse effects, but there still needs to be a lot more research because very high doses can trigger anxiety and fear. And there's some dizziness, increase in blood pressure and heart rate and mood swings and fatigue. So now at least you know the overall look at that. Okay, that's all for today, and we'll take more tomorrow. You know the number you can call. Now I want to go directly into, well, before I go into the Aldous Huxley interview, which is really classic, and for younger people or those of you who are under the age of 50, you may not, you may have no knowledge of Aldous Huxley, but he is as important a figure as George Orwell was with 1984. But first, I want to share some insights, then we'll go directly into it. And the whole interview can be watched and appreciated on PRN.fm. When we look at the world today, the people who more often than not who make policies or lead the opinion to the people to convince them that the policy is correct are in the media. And they're known and frequently respected. Those in the more conservative political areas, such as Rush Limbaugh, or let's say Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham over on Fox, and people reading some literature that is biased and towards a more conservative perspective. Now, the people going to these people on a regular basis believe them, and rarely, if ever, are going to question them or look to see whether or not they are being sold misinformation? Are they being propagandized? Are they being conditioned to believe without looking for the truth themselves? The same is true on the liberal side. And when we're really objective and honest, we see that both sides do a disservice because they're starting off with a biased position and then only cherry-picking the information that selectively supports their particular position. So it starts high and works down to the masses, and it doesn't take a lot to influence many people. And it's in every administration. For example, in Ronald Reagan's administration, 60% of his cabinet came from private sector. By the way, the same amount that came from Eisenhower's cabinet. Examples, Dick Cheney was Defense Department. He had worked at Halliburton. Frank Carlucci was Cheney's successor. He was director of the Carlyle Group of Global Investments. These are the ultimate neocons. And these are the people that believe in hegemony everywhere. Secretaries of the Treasury, Secretaries of Agriculture, Secretaries of Commerce, Secretary of Labor, Secretary of House and Housing and Transportation, Secretary of Small Businesses Administration, all came from the private sector. In fact, there were 264 people who worked in industry or corporate lobbying before and were brought into the Reagan administration. Therefore, what they believed in, what they believed was true, how they saw the world, what benefited their special groups, then was given to the voices, the faces, the propagandists to go forward and condition the public so that they will believe in their own captivity. Then you had George Bush, Sr. A major portion of his cabinet in the top positions all came within special interests. Secretary of Commerce, Moshbacher, and later Evans, Secretary of Treasury, O'Neill, Small Business Administration, Barreto. 176 people in his administration in important positions all worked in industry or corporate lobbying and then either went from the government into those positions or came from those positions, went to government, and then went back. It's a revolving door. So whose interests did they serve? Now, one of the worst was Bill Clinton. For example, Robert Rubin had been the head of Citigroup and at that time was the most powerful bank in America. And he had been, it was brought in to be the Treasury Secretary. Lloyd Benson, Rubin's successor, was with, he was a lobbyist for Bernhard and McPherson. William Daley, Commerce Secretary, was a telecom giant at SBC Corporation. Stuart Eisenstadt was our Deputy Secretary of Treasury. He was a corporate lobbyist. He had no background in Treasury. And almost never does anyone have real experience, you know, when they're given a position in government, including the President of the United States. Charles Brain, Director of the White House Legislative Affairs, he was a corporate lobbyist. And Energy Secretary O'Leary and Chief of Staff McCleary came from the private sector. Michael Taylor, Secretary of Agriculture, was Monsanto's attorney, as well as senior advisor to the FDA. So here's a person coming from Monsanto, there's your glyphosate and genetically engineered seeds, coming into a policymaking position at both the FDA and the White House, or being with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. 1,012 people from industry and corporate lobbying were brought in under Clinton. Now do you get an idea why the Clintons were accepted with all of their vices and all their criminality and their rapacious nature, their pathological personalities, their sociopathic personalities? Because they were opening doors for hundreds of billions of dollars to be made in different industries with no questions asked. And that's why they had to be protected. They had to be promoted. Putting a virtue on them by virtue signaling, well, she's a woman. Well, you know, he plays the jazz and wears dark sunglasses, so he must be a cool dude. No, he was a psychopath, you know. So anyhow, that's how they get in power. George Bush Jr., Cheney, Rumsfeld, Henry Paulson, Donald Evans, Martinez, Norma Mineta, Paul O'Neill, 1,029 people within that administration came from Lockheed Martin and Rand Corporation, and they were came from CSX, the nation's largest railroad company. They came from biotech companies. So whose interest was promoted by these 1,029 people, all in policymaking positions? It was industries, not the people. Obama, my God, Obama loaded his place. Do you know that Obama had 65 former lobbyists for big business in his administration as policymakers who had no experience in what they had done? Sean Donovan, Secretary of Housing, was Director of Prudential Mortgage Capital. Timothy Geithner was from Wall Street. Stephen Chu, Secretary of Energy, was from Bell Labs. And Ken Salazar was Interior Secretary, was also from private industry. Tom Vilsack was Monsanto insider. Eric Holder came from a private law firm and went back to that same law firm. 781 people from industry and corporate lobbying were policymakers. And Trump, well, Trump, 90% of his appointees are from private industry. 187 have been lobbyists, 254 of Trump's appointees, and 125 leading staffers are from conservative and right-wing think tanks. 25 appointees are from the Heritage Foundation alone. 35 appointees at one time worked for the Koch brothers, and most of the Koch's Freedom Partner Chamber of Commerce are in Trump's administration and creating his policies. Approximately 60% of Trump's policy recommendations come from the Heritage Foundation. And also, it has the smallest percentage of women and non-white cabinet members since Reagan. And Reagan was the worst on record. There are too many appointees to name, but the main ones have been Tillerson, Manchin from Treasury, Ross from Commerce, McMahon from Small Business. These are all pro-business people. You know, just foolish. That's just foolish. So understand that's how we get to a place where the government controls everything in our lives because they also control the media. So that's just to give you an idea that it's a circle. And in this protective circle, you have a hierarchy, and they work together. It doesn't matter whether you're conservative or liberal. That's irrelevant. It means that they then have to control the media so that the policymakers then control the media, who are the opinion leaders. And within the media, you have newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, and then you have media like Fox on one side and MSNBC on the other. None of them serve your interest. They're serving the oligarch interest, and that's totalitarian. And that's what we're not paying attention to. And that's why it's so important that we understand this. Now, just to take it a bit further before we go to this interview, because I do want to share some of these insights. Let me put it this way. America is in a state of crisis. I think we could all agree with that. But according to Henry Giroux, this crisis touches every aspect of public life, extending from a crisis of economics produced by massive inequality that the media rarely focuses upon those who are poor and middle class, but rather focuses upon how much money someone has made, how they're spending it. Look at their yacht, look at their penthouse, look at their cars, look at how many homes they have. Oh, gee whiz, look at how much money they have. But never once do they say, what are the ethics underlying how you accumulated your wealth, and to what degree have you used this wealth to gain even more power as a policymaker and opinion leader? Never that question is raised by the media. It's merely showing the decadency, much like the court of Henry XIV. I'll get to that on a different show. So what it means is this. It means that we are in a new historical period, one in which everything is transformed and corrupted by the neoliberal tools of financialization, deregulation, and austerity. So within this new nexus of power, and anti-democratic principles have become normalized and hence weakened, and society's democratic defenses gone. Egregious degrees of exploitation and unchecked militarism, and now matched by a politics of disposability and terminal exclusion, in which human beings are now matched by a politics of disposability that says that you are viewed as the embodiment of human waste. This is reinforced, if not propelled, by the ethos of white nationalism and white supremacy. Fascist principles, or one version of what journalist Natasha Leonard calls microfascism, now operates at so many levels of everyday society that it's difficult to recognize them, especially as they have the imprimatur of the President of the United States. Fascist practices and desires work through diverse social media platforms and mainstream and right-wing cultural apparatuses in multiple ways. They largely function ideologically and politically to objectify people and promote spectacular elements of violence, like we're going to destroy you, you know, make one more move and you're going to be obliterated, or simply the way that we no longer can conduct ourselves civilly. Look at the different violence that is committed on a daily basis that we have been normalized to. The violence of a nuclear reactor going off at Fukushima, and 8 years later, nothing has been done, nothing done to correct the situation, only to clean up what can be cleaned up, but no unified effort to encase us, to put a gigantic sarcophagus around as if it doesn't matter, because it's not in our mindset, because the media doesn't say it's important to us. So what the media doesn't say is important is no longer important. Where the children dying by the hundreds of thousands, or at least malnourished by the hundreds of thousands, and into the millions in Yemen, in a war that should never have occurred, that we have participated, we have enabled, and hence it's on the heads of all those who support in the United States Congress the budget that allows this to occur, or the enslavement of people in North Africa, in Libya, that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama enabled. They are not held accountable, yet it is their crime against humanity. It is a human genocide. And yet today, we normalize these genocides, we normalize violence, we normalize the culture of hyperviolence, as long as it serves some ideological, political, or economic, or material need. As a result, we are functioning largely, ideologically, and politically, only as objects. And that's unfortunate. We construct psychological borders in people's minds in order to privilege certain groups and promote mindlessness through the ubiquity of celebrity culture, and we normalize the discourse of hate in everyday exchanges, which is produced endlessly. That said, now, in the fog of social and historical amnesia and moral boundaries disappearing, and people becoming more accepting of extreme acts of cruelty and the propaganda machines that create alternative thoughts and views any viable critique of power as fake news, and all the while disconnecting talkish language and politics as if it's normal. It's not. Example, if you're a mother whose child has died because of the Gardasil vaccine, and you find out that there are over 500 other mothers whose children have died and over 40,000 who've been seriously injured, including hospitalizations and paralysis, and you go to your pediatrician, you're denied a reality. You go to the press, you're denied a reality. You go to the government, you're denied a reality. You're just objectified now, not just as a mourning parent seeking some form of redress to see what actually happened, but no one's going to be there. You go to Wikipedia, and it codifies the official view. There's no problem with the vaccines. It couldn't have caused that. And so you're then left with a massive guilt that somehow genetically you predisposed your child to die prematurely. You're leading that guilt every day of your life, and no one else takes responsibility. That's the danger of totalitarianism. That's the danger of fascism. That's the danger of unique groups gaining power and controlling all messages. That's what Google does, Facebook does. These are criminal organizations. These are run by sociopaths. And I get no pleasure in saying that anyone working for these organizations take a careful look at throughout history and look at the Nuremberg Codes. If you work for an operation that is engaged in acts against humanity, you are equally responsible. You can no longer say, I was just following orders. I was just getting a paycheck. Now, we know that they're spying on us. We know that we have no freedoms. We know that we're in a police state. We know that they can take our assets. They can break in our doors. They can listen to our phone calls. We know we can be indicted for nothing. We know that they have trolls and PR machines that can create any form of false narrative about you. You could be a priest with a blemish-free record, and they can make you out to be complete evil. That's the power they have. And the public, mindless and completely lacking in desire for intentional knowledge, will stay in an intentional neglect, and hence, whatever the public is told, they will believe. Now let's go to the conversation between Aldous Huxley and Mike Wallace.
Of hell on earth. A searing social critic, Mr. Huxley, 27 years ago wrote Brave New World, a novel that predicted that someday the entire world would live under a frightful dictatorship. Today, Mr. Huxley says that his fictional world of horror is probably just around the corner for all of us. We'll find out why in a moment.
The Mike Wallace Interview, presented by the American Broadcasting Company in association with the Fund for the Republic, brings you a special television series discussing
some of the most electric novels and social criticism of this century. He's just finished a series of essays called Enemies of Freedom, in which he outlines and defines some of the threats to our freedom in the United States. And Mr. Huxley, right off the bat, let me ask you this. As you see it, who and what are the enemies of freedom here in the United States?
Well, I don't think you can say who in the United States. I don't think there are any sinister persons deliberately trying to rob people of their freedom. But I do think, first of all, that there are a number of impersonal forces which are pushing in the direction of less and less freedom. And I also think that there are a number of technological devices which anybody who wishes to use can use to accelerate this process of going away from freedom, of imposing control.
Well, what are these forces and these devices, Mr. Huxley?
I should say that there are two main impersonal forces. The first of them is not exceedingly important in the United States at the present time, though very important in other countries. This is the force which in general terms can be called overpopulation, the mounting pressure of population pressing upon existing resources. This, of course, is an extraordinary thing. Something is happening which has never happened in the world's history before. I mean, let's just take a simple fact that between the time of the birth of Christ and the landing of the Mayflower, the population of the Earth doubled. It rose from 250 million to probably 500 million. Today, the population of the Earth is rising at such a rate that it will double in half a century.
Well, why should overpopulation work to diminish our freedoms?
Well, in a number of ways. I mean, the experts in the field, like Harrison Brown, for example, pointed out that in the underdeveloped countries, actually the standard of living is at present falling, that people have less to eat and less goods per capita than they had 50 years ago. And as the position of these countries, the economic position, becomes more and more precarious, obviously the central government has to take over more and more responsibility for keeping the ship of state on an even keel. And then, of course, you're likely to get social unrest under such conditions, with again an intervention of the central government. So that I think one sees here a pattern which seems to be pushing very strongly towards a totalitarian regime. And unfortunately, as in all these underdeveloped countries, the only highly organized political party is the Communist Party, it looks rather as though they will be the heirs to this unfortunate process, that they will step into the power, position of power.
Well, then, ironically enough, one of the greatest forces against communism in the world, the Catholic Church, according to your thesis, would seem to be pushing us directly into the hands of the communists because they are against birth control.
Well, I think this strange paradox probably is true. There is an extraordinary situation, actually. I mean, one has to look at it, of course, from a biological point of view. The whole essence of biological life on Earth is a question of balance, and what we have done is to practice death control in a most intensive manner without balancing this with birth control at the other end. Consequently, the birth rates remain as high as they were, and death rates have fallen substantially.
All right, then. So much for the time being, anyway, for overpopulation. Another force that is diminishing our freedoms.
Well, another force which I think is very strongly operative in this country is the force of what may be called over-organization. As technology becomes more and more complicated, it becomes necessary to have more and more elaborate organizations, more hierarchical organizations. And incidentally, the advance of technology has been accompanied by an advance in the science of organization. It's now possible to make organizations on a larger scale than was ever possible before. And so that you have more and more people living their lives out as subordinates in these hierarchical systems controlled by bureaucracies, either the bureaucracies of big business or the bureaucracies of big government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the devices that you were talking about, are there specific devices or methods of communication which diminish our freedoms in addition to overpopulation and over-organization?
Well, there are certainly devices which can be used in this way. I mean, let us take, after all, a piece of very recent and very painful history is the propaganda used by Hitler, which was incredibly effective. I mean, what were Hitler's methods? Hitler used terror on the one kind, brute force on the one hand, but he also used a very efficient form of propaganda, which he was using every modern device at that time. He didn't have TV, but he had the radio, which he used to the fullest extent, and was able to impose his will on an immense mass of people. I mean, the Germans were a highly educated people.
Well, we're aware of all this, but how do you equate Hitler's use of propaganda with the way that propaganda, if you will, is used let us say, here in the United States. Well, are you suggesting that there is a parallel?
Needless to say, it's not being used in this way now. But the point is, it seems to me, that there are methods at present available, methods superior in some respects to Hitler's method, which could be used in a bad situation. I mean, what I feel very strongly is that we mustn't be caught by surprise by our own advancing technology. This has happened again and again in history. Technology has advanced, and this changes social conditions, and suddenly people have found themselves in a situation which they didn't foresee and doing all sorts of things they didn't really want to do.
Well, now, what do you mean? Do you mean that we develop our television but we don't know how to use it correctly? Is that the point that you're making?
Well, at present, the television, I think, is being used quite harmlessly. It's being used, I think, I would feel it's being used too much to distract everybody all the time. But, I mean, imagine, which must be the situation in all communist countries, where the television, where it exists, is always saying the same thing the whole time, is always driving along. It's not creating a wide front of distraction. It's creating a one-pointed drumming in of a single idea all the time. It's obviously an immensely powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the potential misuse of the instrument.
Exactly. We have, after all technology is in itself morally neutral. These are just powers which can either be used well or ill. It's the same thing with atomic energy. We can either use it to blow ourselves up, or we can use it as a substitute for the coal and the oil which are running out.
You've even written about the use of drugs in this light.
Well, now, this is a very interesting subject. I mean, in this book that you mentioned, this book of mine, Brave New World, I postulated a substance called Soma, which was a very versatile drug. It would make people feel happy in small doses. It would make them see visions in medium doses, and it would send them to sleep in large doses. Well, I don't think such a drug exists now, nor do I think it will ever exist, but we do have drugs which will do some of these things, and I think it's quite on the cards that we may have drugs which will profoundly change our mental states without doing us any harm. I mean, this is the pharmacological revolution which has taken place, that we have now powerful mind-changing drugs which, physiologically speaking, are almost costless. I mean, they are not like opium or like cocaine, which do change the state of mind, but leave terrible results physiologically and morally.
Mr. Huxley, in your new essays, you state that these various enemies of freedom are pushing us toward a real-life, brave new world, and you say that it's awaiting us just around the corner. First of all, can you detail for us what life in this brave new world, which you fear so much, what life might be like?
Well, to start with, I think this kind of the dictatorship of the future, I think, will be very unlike the dictatorships which we've been familiar with in the immediate past. I mean, take another book prophesying the future, which was a very remarkable book, George Orwell's 1984. Mm-hmm. Well, this book was written at the height of the Stalinist regime and just after the Hitler regime. And there he foresaw a dictatorship using entirely the methods of terror, the methods of physical violence. Now, I think what is going to happen in the future is the dictators will find, as the old saying goes, that you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you want to preserve your power indefinitely, you have to get the consent of the ruled. And this they will do partly by drugs, as I foresaw in Brave New World, partly by these new techniques of propaganda. They will do it by bypassing the sort of rational side of man and appealing to his subconscious and his deeper emotions and his physiology even, and so making him actually love his slavery. I mean, I think this is the danger, that actually people may be in some ways happy under the new regime, but they will be happy in a situation where they oughtn't to be happy.
But let me ask you this. You're talking about a world that could take place within the confines of a totalitarian state. Hmm. Let's become more immediate, more urgent about it. We believe, anyway, that we live in a democracy here in the United States. Do you believe that this brave new world that you talk about could, let's say in the next quarter century, the next century, could come here to our shores?
I think it could. I mean, that's why I feel it's so extremely important here and now to start thinking about these problems, not to let ourselves be taken by surprise by the new advances in technology. I mean, for example, in regard to the use of the drugs, we know there's enough evidence now for us to be able, on the basis of this evidence and using a certain amount of creative imagination, to foresee the kind of uses which could be made in by people of bad will with these things, and to attempt.
There's another 20 minutes of this interview that is very valuable for you to read. I just wanted to get an overview. He believed that the answer to the future were drugs. Well, today the answer to many people's lives every day is drugs. We've pathologized children. We believe that if a child does anything that is normal, it's abnormal, and therefore drug them. Give them a diagnosis. We believe that if you're sad, it is a brain chemical imbalance. It is not. It's a natural life's a happenstance. So give them a drug. So his dystopian, his utopian view of drugs has become a dystopian reality. But he says the medium, Marshall McLuhan said the same thing, the medium is the message. So we're believing the media, and we're believing their messages, left and right. We shouldn't. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.